This is Great FM, a podcast series by Great HR. Produced by Timber Media.
Hello and welcome to Great FM, everyone. I'm your host, Ahalya, and I'm really looking forward to the conversation that we've got in store for you today. You know, diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI, has been a big topic of conversation on our podcast ever since we started. But today, it's actually time for us to just take a pause and reevaluate, talk about what's working and what isn't. Interestingly enough, we're recording this podcast at a time where DEIB initiatives and policies at the workplace have come under quite a bit of scrutiny. So I guess it's a valuable conversation for us to be having today. And it's also for good reason that we pull it back into the conversation every few months, because let me just quote some stats here, right? McKinsey research concludes that companies in the top 25% for ethnic and cultural diversity were 36% more profitable than those in the bottom quarter. And when women are well represented in the C-suite, profits can be almost 50% higher. Glassdoor, another statistic there, reports that 76% of employees and job seekers say that diversity, and I quote, is an important factor when evaluating companies and job offers. So the list of statistics really does go on and on, but like I was saying, DEIB policies have come under debate for being nothing but a checklist. And the world is diverse, people are complex, individual needs are different, and it seems that the only way forward is flexibility and personalization. So today we're talking about how we can go beyond the checklist and adopt DEIB strategies that create real and meaningful impact. And there's no one better than Joanne Lockwood, founder and CEO of See Change Happen, a recognized keynote speaker and thought leader on inclusion and belonging, to help us through it. You know, as a transgender woman in her 50s, she brings a very unique perspective and much needed perspective to the conversation. So thrilled to have her on the show. Welcome, Joanne. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's an honor to be here.
So Joanne, let's sort of start with a bit of an experiential question. You know, we've been doing that this year on the podcast. Could you maybe open up the conversation with the first ever time that a DEIB policy actually helped you in your own personal experience? And the first time that you realized that DEIB policies, on the other hand, need to be better thought out?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I've been trying to think about it in my mind just to really crystallize this. And I'm going to be really honest that for 50 odd years of my life, I had no idea about DEIB policies. It didn't register on my radar at all. Why should it? So before I gender transitioned, I lived my life as a white male in society. I never needed or never felt the need to be included, because I felt I was included by default. So the first time I realized that it actually mattered to me as an individual, was after I gender transitioned and I was seeking employment in that phase while I was trying to get my consultancy set up. I then realized that I was no longer in the majority. I was no longer automatically included. I was falling into this voiceless, marginalized, underrepresented, these other tick boxes that we put people in. So that made me realize that when we talk about this DEI pushback, when we talk about people who are marginalized, people who are underrepresented, getting all of the advantages, it's because when you have all the advantages, you don't realize the power and importance of those processes. So that's when I first realized they need to be better thought out, because I felt that people were clumsier about me, my pronouns, my name, my identity, and I found that I was no longer being accepted by default. So that's really the nub of when I first became aware at the age of 52, that as a transgender woman, trying to look for her first role in an organization.
You know, because you brought up, right, Joanne, that it is so important to have these policies in place, even from the statistics that we touched upon at the opening of the conversation, it clearly brings progress and it clearly brings quite a bit of good into the organization, right? So why do you think DEIB somewhere along the way became just a checklist item, right? Is it one of those things, in your opinion, where you start something new, it falls into routine, people become complacent, or do you think that it finds its root somewhere else?
Whether you call it a checklist, whether you call it a playbook, whether you call it a strategy, whether you call it company policy, whatever you want to call it, I think it's important that we have consistency. When we have consistency, we know how I fit in that process. You know, as a marginalized person myself, I need to understand what you as a company are doing. So I expect you to have a tried and tested process. Your inclusion credentials, your inclusion strategy must include me. So I think if we're not careful, when we're trying to implement these policies, we have to have consistency. I have to be able to trust you that you're following a good process. So inevitably, that will lead to creating a checklist, a playbook, or whatever it may be, because there are so many cogs in this process, so many people in this chain, that it's important everybody knows what the overall strategy is. So I think, yes, a checklist is important. But the question is, when did it become just a checklist, I suppose? And that's where it becomes performative. That's where organizations are kind of saying, here's our process, here's our checklist, this is what we're going through the motions. And I think what happens is people forget about the humanity. They forget about the point of the checklist. They forget about the point of the process. And that's about creating environments, cultures, organizations where everyone can thrive for who they are. And that's sometimes forgotten in the acronym DEIBJ, whatever acronym you want to use. That's where we lose it, when we start focusing on these letters and words rather than the output. And I always talk about the output as being positive people experiences. That's what we're trying to create in our society, in our cultures, in our organizations, in the hiring process, in the candidate experience, in our employee experience. I want a positive experience dealing with you as a customer, you as an organization, you as a candidate. And that's sometimes what we get lost in this checklist process. So I think we keep the checklist, so we've got to have consistency. But the point of that checklist is creating positive experiences. That's what we need to get to.
That is such a well-articulated thought, actually, because I think in today's day and age, more than anything or any time in history, I think organizational culture is really coming up strong in terms of an absolute requirement and priority. People may not be prioritizing it, but I think there's no ignoring the fact that it has to be prioritized. And it's more about, once you've got that checklist, what do the human beings in the organization do to actually implement it, right? And how do they implement it? But that also throws up that fine line. I mean, people are complicated. So everyone's dealing with their own set of problems or issues that, they may turn to the workplace to solve. But then you've also got an organization full of people. So how do HR professionals walk that very fine line without overlooking either stakeholder, but also keeping business goals or, overarching strategy in mind?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think we've got to avoid creating hierarchy of need or hierarchy of privilege. We've got to look at equity, building equity in our processes, playing, if you like, whack-a-mole, splat the rat, whatever analogy you want to use, where we're working out the inequities in the system from a neurodiversity perspective, from a race perspective, from a gender perspective, and treating each of those inequities as a holistic need to solve, whilst also recognizing the intersectionality where people may be affected by more than one characteristic simultaneously that comes into play. So by looking at that holistic, person-centric approach, really important. I go back to this positive people experiences that I talked about just now. That's what we're trying to create. And it's not about trying to trade off one group versus another group. The other aspect in business is, if we think about, I go back to ancient Greek philosophy of Aristotle, there's the three pillars: ethos, logos, and pathos. Ethos being the ethical response, the policy, the checklist. We have this because it's the law. The logos is the logical response, which is the spreadsheet, the balance sheet, the business imperative, the need to generate revenue, the need to generate sustainable income, the need to justify our costs. Very important. But the pathos is the human-centered approach. So if we focus on our people first and get it right for our people in retention, our employee experience, our stakeholder experience, everyone's experience, then we're going to be more successful and profitable and get a better return. And then we'll be compliant. So I always come back to this. It's got to be a people-led initiative, people-led strategy. Bears in mind the business need and the compliance need. We've got to focus on doing it right for the people first.
A great point there also about not building a hierarchy of needs, I think, because people are very different and individual, and their experiences are very individual as well. I want to break up the next question I had for you into two, actually, and talk a little bit about the expectations in the workplace, right? So let's start with first setting them. What do you think, in terms of HR professionals and leadership, right? What do you think is the scope of the expectations that they can and should set for the professionals in the workplace? And then we'll go into the employee bit after.
I think great cultures allow organizations to collaborate, communicate, listen, and share with each other as a first, if you like, priority. We talk about buzzwords like psychological safety. I need to be able to speak up. I need to be able to share my truth, but I also have to have accountability of my views and my beliefs. Yeah, I have to understand the impact of what I'm saying, what I'm doing, what I'm thinking. So if we're not careful, what we end up doing is we put people in silos and we put people in conflict because people are trying to think about through their own lens, through their own blinkers, through their own needs. What we have to try and do is get people to think about everybody's needs. And that's not always easy when you're talking to someone who feels that they're being discriminated against or being marginalized. We have to look at the context in all of this. So I think context is really important. Communication is important. So when we talk about HR professionals, what we're trying to do is we're trying to create cultures and organizations where people can express their views, people can understand their views are being listened to, but they also recognize they have a responsibility to also listen to other people's views and moving to a point where no one has to be right. Being right is not the objective. Understanding why someone thinks something is more important than having your view validated. If I can understand what you think or why you think something, and someone else can understand why I think something, then we can have a conversation on that why. I don't have to agree with what you believe in and how you believe it. That's fine. So I think trying to get better conversations, better dialogues, and more importantly, getting people to communicate with open arms and not folded arms.
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it. Open arms and folded arms. I like that. I also want to then do the follow-up, right? Which is for professionals in the workplace. What do you think is fair, the expectations that they can and again should have from their workplace?
Yeah, I think it's reasonable that we should all have dignity and respect, and people have that of us. I'm a great believer in the FRIDA principles. So FRIDA is FREDA, so fairness, respect, equity or equality, dignity and autonomy. So if we can make sure we have those through psychological safety, that learner safety, that inclusion safety, that contributor safety, and what we can do is we can make sure that if we're feeling that sense of belonging in our organization, then we have that responsibility to generate that feeling in others. So again, it comes back to the culture that the management, HR, the organization set, but we also have to have our own part of responsibility in that. I can't expect unreserved inclusion and belonging for me if I'm not prepared to ensure that others also share and benefit in that sense of belonging as well. So again, intent, impact, and accountability. So I have to recognize my best intent may often land badly. I may use the wrong language. I may not be thinking about somebody else in the same way that I think about myself. So I have to be responsible for that, accountable for that action I take. So I think if we can get people to understand that they can have their own views, they can have their own beliefs, they can have their own needs, but that can't be in isolation to others. I think, again, it comes down to personal responsibility, self-leadership.
Yeah, I think again, very valuable perspective there. Now, a lot of your work, Joanne, lies in helping large organizations really foster inclusive cultures. And it's more about allowing this culture to blossom, right? It's not just about survival. And I think through the course of your career, you've also had to then, socialize all of these ideas, these frameworks across levels in the organization, right? So, in your experience, what do you think is the role of leadership in driving personalized DEIB to fruition, right? To making it successful? Do they play a huge role in it? And how can HR sort of bridge that gap?
Well, we think of leadership as being a strategic role in all parts of the organization. So we're looking to our leaders to lead, to set strategy, to guide us, to clear barriers, to make sure that my success in my role is guaranteed because they're, if you like, providing the environment for me. So the leaders there are instrumental. And I think organizations don't do enough to upskill their leaders. We often promote people who are great technicians, great at what they do, without helping them upskill to be fantastic leaders. So being a leader, being a people person, can be learned, can be trained, can be something you can develop and nurtured in the same way emotional intelligence, cultural intelligence, and other aspects can be. So I think it is critical for leaders to recognize their purpose in this. They set the standard. They have to have courage to stand up for what they believe in and what the organization believes in. They have to collaborate with other leaders within the organization, with other teams. They have to be able to listen and gain access to sort of knowledge and best practice. And they have to have commitment to the goals because if you can't trust your leader to support you, to hold up the goals, to hold up the organizational values, you're going to lose faith, not just in the organization, but in your team and everything else. So leaders have a critical role here to model best behavior, to guide people, to lead from the front and show what fantastic looks like and does look like, helping people on that journey to create better cultures, better environments where everyone starts to work together. And also, I think the other thing is, having the courage to call it out or call it in when it's not working. you do need to, as a leader, have those brave conversations, have those challenging conversations, be able to coach people into better ways of behaving when they may not be receptive to that.
100%, I think a bit of courage goes a very, very long way. And I think it's also about embodying that spirit on an individual level, a collective level, to really, enable transformation and redefine what excellence means. That's, exactly what we've been encouraging companies to do with our Great to Great campaign here at Great HR, because, HR departments, HR professionals have the opportunity today to be at the center of that transformation. So it really is about taking all of that efficiency and effectiveness, which is great, and taking it a step further, delivering an ecosystem that, simplifies all of these processes and approaches, but most importantly, enhances employee experiences. And that's what we're chasing at the end of the day, right? I do want to touch upon the metrics of it all. Funnily enough, when we opened the conversation, we did it with statistics, but I think the measurement of something always boils down to numbers and then can also very quickly become a checklist item, becomes about hitting your targets, right? Are there any unique approaches, especially when we're talking about personalized DEIB? Joanne, do you think, one, the approach to measuring the impact of DEIB policies and strategies needs to change? And also, when it does change, are there any ways that go beyond numbers of measuring the impact and how meaningful some of these strategies may have been?
Yeah, when I work with organizations, one of the first questions I always ask a board is, why am I here? What am I doing here? Why do you want to change? What's wrong? What's the why? And trying to get down to the root cause of what is up where they are and where do they want to get to? And some of that, where do you want to get to, has to be based on a starting point. So where are you now? Why is where you are now not good enough for you? What do you need to change? So you want to change your gender pay gap, change your ethnicity pay gap, hire more people with a disability. And I go back to why. Why do you want to do this? Why does it matter to you as an individual, as a leader, and you as an organization? Because unless we get down to that why, nothing we ever do is going to change because it won't be sticky. So let's get the stats and the metrics about who you are now. So your current demographic, your employee engagement scores, your pulse scores, whatever they may be, how your customers feel, how do your stakeholders feel. So all of the different people involved in these processes, we need to understand who they are, what do they think, and why do they think things. Then we've got our baseline. Then we can start using that baseline to plot our trajectory. And I'm not a believer in goals and targets and grand spreadsheets about where we're trying to get to. I want to have a vision on the wall that says, wouldn't it be fantastic in 2030 if we had equity in our gender across pay, across positions, across seniority in the company? Wouldn't it be great if we had more representation of people of color, more representation of people with disability, of LGBT community in our organization? Because that's a reflection on society. So that's our stated intent. And then we say, okay, in order to get to our stated intent, that fantastic vision on the wall of 2030, how do we need to get there? Then we can plot a course. In order to achieve that by 2030, where do we need to be in 2025? Where do we need to be in 2026? So again, by breaking this down to manageable goals, we can then create timelines, we can then create work streams in order to achieve progress towards those goals. And again, I go back, it's not a quota, it's not a target, it's not an absolute. It's about a trajectory. So this is where we're heading, and a velocity. And that velocity may well change depending on which goal, which target. Because sometimes if we go too fast, we leave people behind. And if we go too slow, we frustrate people. So I'm a great believer in this vector of travel and our velocity, and we course correct based on our actual progress towards that goal and whilst looking at the world around us to make sure things haven't changed. So whatever it matters to you as an organization, those are your goals and they shouldn't be somebody else's goals. That's really, really important. And that's what I help organizations work on in the first instance, is to find their goals, their priorities, and their why.
Yeah, no, I mean, that kind of feels like a bit of a meta moment because, we're talking about personalized DEIB, but also the approach to that is so personalized, right? And that leads me perfectly into my next question, Joanne, which is bringing it back to HR professionals and their behavior, their roles and responsibilities in the workplace once again. What do they need to be changing when it comes to policy creation? Are there new strategies or approaches that you think they should be adopting, maybe a mindset shift?
I'm not a great believer in creating policies. I'm a bit more of a free spirit than being governed by policy. So I think what we need to go back to as HR professionals is the overall goal and objectives. And that is creating environments where people can thrive through their own ability. and given them the tools they need to succeed in order to allow them to grow and develop in the organization. That's fundamentally what we're trying to achieve here. And then in addition to that, minimize friction, minimize conflict to create environments where people feel safe, they feel welcomed, and they feel part of belonging, that magic, if you like. So that's got to be our North Star of what we as HR professionals are trying to guide people towards. And ask yourself, is the policy I'm creating achieving that goal? Or is the policy I'm creating about stopping people do things? I find too often that HR policies are about preventing something rather than enabling something. So we can flip that on its head to think about when we create these work streams, these practices, how do we enable people to be adults, to grow, to be responsible, and to take their own growth seriously. So that's our HR professionals. Let's flip this on our head. Let's look at policies that enable, not policies that disable. So that's been my starting point.
That's so interesting because, I don't think when a policy or any kind of framework is implemented in the workplace, or at least one would hope, it's not done to, restrict or hinder someone's growth, right? But I guess a lot of times we see things very linear and we don't realize the eventual outcome of something like that that exists in the workplace.
Can I give you another example? So, if
Of
you think
course, yeah.
about policies over recent years, I think about in the UK, we enforced smoking bans in the office. So suddenly we had a policy on smoking and smoking in cars, smoking here where we can smoke outside. That's a policy. So we created a policy to stop people smoking. We have working time directives. You mustn't work too long. You don't do this, mustn't do that. So those are kind of rule-based policies. But we've also got other great policies which are around parental leave, people going through building a family, whether it's going through IVF, going through surrogacy, going through whatever. So those are kind of good enabling policies. So I'm not saying every policy is bad, because some of them do create space where people can do what they want to do. But as I say, look at the output of that policy. Is the output of that policy positive to allow someone to do something, or is it a negative policy that stops someone doing something? And then we want more policies that enable, as I say, than disable. That's kind of the crux of it for me.
That's interesting. And if I could maybe just ask you to elaborate a little bit on that so that our listeners get a better idea in your experience or from your experience. And of course, if you're comfortable answering this, is there a policy you can talk to us about that, maybe was put in place with the best of intentions, but you've seen that, people at the organization do have seen that it's actually not done what it's supposed to?
Well, I think if you look at the high macro level, you look at what's going on globally with DEI as a buzzword, as a buzz phrase. We see it in the US around this whole rhetoric around inclusive hiring. People have been trying to give equity to, recognizing that people of color, people with disability, people LGBTQ plus were not getting hired in the same rate as people who are male, people who are white. So what's happened is in these organizations is people who are white and male look at these policies and say, hang on a minute. I'm now being marginalized. I'm now being excluded. So I say that's an example, if you like, of a well-intentioned policy to give equity to a certain group of people, effectively marginalizes and excludes a different group of people. So that's the conflict we've got to have sometimes in these policies. By creating equity and enabling people, it's seen sometimes as creating negative and disabling people. So that's the balance we've got to try and find as HR professionals, DEI professionals, is trying to create inclusion without excluding somebody else. And that's this paradox of inclusion sometimes.
Yeah, no, that's a very valuable point. Thank you so much for sort of taking us through that. We've reached the end of our conversation today, but one last question, and I think this one will probably leave everyone with a wealth of information, right? Are there some tangible examples of personalized DEIB? We all know the general DEIB frameworks and policies, etc., that exist. We've experienced them, right, and made use of them in our workplace. But are there any tangible examples of personalized DEIB that have worked, that have been successful, that you can share with us?
Yeah, these are more anecdotal rather than written down. I'll give you an example. I was working with an organization who we talked about inclusive hiring. So I developed some training, some onboarding, and some processes they could follow to enhance their hiring process. And I went back after 6 months and someone said to them, so how are you getting on? I said, well, absolutely fantastic, because we've got three candidates we placed into roles that we would not normally have considered through our old process. So managers actually said, yeah, we've hired these fantastic people and we admit we would not have hired them had it been through the old process. Okay, so that's a tangible thing. Then you ask the people who were actually hired, and they say, yeah, their process was fantastic. I was able to engage in this process in a way that I've never engaged with anybody else. And I always felt that I had trust in the system and was given a fair chance to succeed for who I am, and I was listened to. So that's one clear example that when you get it right, your hiring experience is improved and the actual candidate experience is improved as well. So that if you magnify that across the board, just in that one particular case study I did there, then that's the output we're looking for. Let's say these positive experiences, hiring people, promoting people, and succeeding with people that you would not normally have given the opportunity to. And then seeing how they're smiling and benefiting from that change.
This has been a very informative conversation, Joanne, and a lot of very thought-provoking shifts in mindset when it comes to thinking about how DEIB initiatives can actually exist within an organization. And I do think that this podcast is making me want to extend the conversation into a culture conversation as well. Hopefully, we can do that soon. But thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Great FM.
Yes, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat to you today. Thank you.
And before you leave, is there one little piece of advice that you want to give HR professionals listening in? We do have quite an audience. So anything you'd like to tell them that they can go into the workplace and adopt like tomorrow?
Often people say to me that they're scared of getting it wrong, saying the wrong thing, doing the wrong thing, and that often constrains them. They would rather do nothing than do something wrong. I always say to people is be brave. Recognize the three elements I talked about earlier: intent, impact, and accountability. If you start off with positive intent, and then if it goes wrong, measure the impact, but be accountable and apologize and move on. But don't let inaction stop you. Overcome that. Emotional intelligence, cultural intelligence, being hyper-aware and making change for the right reasons and measuring it. You can never get that wrong. Go for it.
Absolutely. That's a wonderful note to end the conversation on. I really hope that all of you listening in take something away from this episode and also enjoyed the conversation today. We'll be back with another episode of Great FM talking about something else that is extremely important from the world of HR. But in the meantime, stay safe and stay happy. We'll see you soon.
This is Great FM, a podcast series by Great HR, produced by Timber Media.